Operator, are you there?
Yes, I am, sir.
Okay, can you open the lines, please? We're continuing with the question and answer segment after the London Economics presentation. Operator, can you inquire if there are any questions from the online participants?
Certainly. Please press star one at this time if you have a question or comment. There are no questions registered at this time, Mr. Shute.
Okay. The floor is open for questions. Travis?
This is Travis Allen with the Retail Council of Canada. Julia, could you go back to your this slide, but for the nuclear options?
This is the nuclear options one. N1 through N6.
Oh, right. Okay, great. Which is the one with the 7 that you added?
That's the hydroelectric.
Oh, okay. Could you go to that one?
Yeah. Sorry. Oops. Too fast. That's slide 13.
Okay, great. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you is about the row called rate stability and reduced earnings volatility. In some of these, we have a situation where H7, the price cap using building blocks, is has a sort of a fuller moon than the regular price cap, which is H5. Is that specifically because you added in the reduced earnings volatility component, or is there also extended price certainty?
Well, I think it's the goal of rate stability and reduced earnings volatility is a goal or objective. In terms of rating different alternatives against that objective, the building blocks approach provides for more. I think that the moon implies it provides for more rate stability and lower earnings volatility, holding all else equal, because of the formulation of how it's actually formed. The way the building blocks approach works in contrast to a price cap is that the X factor itself that becomes part of the formula is not just looking at productivity targets, it's actually smoothing as well, because what it's doing from a calculation perspective is effectively determining a glide path or trajectory for rates based on achieving the net present value of the forecasted revenue requirement over the entire term of the IRM mechanism. And so it not only sets the target for productivity embedded within the revenue requirement calculations, but also for that smoothing function over the term of the IRM.
Right. Because I think, you know, from a consumer's perspective, of course, stable returns are very important because that can be important in terms of reinvestment and continued operation and OPG's, you know, fiscal health. But what a lot of us probably in the room here are concerned with is the impact on the consumer's bill specifically. And so because some of the categories, the Power Advisory Report had broken out, you've combined here. I'm just having a bit of trouble sort of isolating where that bill stability fits in, or where that can be sort of seen on its own.
Well, bill stability is different from lower bill cost, and we do need to differentiate that. This category talks about rate stability or bill stability overall, volatility of that. In terms of thinking about the cost to ratepayers, I think that is effectively, in my opinion at least, embedded in the second category, which is a balanced or pragmatic consideration of the theory and reality in terms of efficiency and reliability, meaning that, in effect, yes, efficiency, holding all else equal over the long term, can drive costs to be lower, which would mean lower costs than would otherwise have arisen. But at the same time, we need to balance the issue of reliability, which has a goal in and of itself, may require some capital investment, which could offset the efficiency improvements made on existing operating costs. So I think there's two, and they're embedded, I think, in that second line. In general, again, with a price cap using the building blocks approach for that category, I also feel that it would be preferred over the simple straight TFP-based price cap because it does allow interested stakeholders to see, depending on how you break it down, OPEX, CAPEX, and even the OPEX line items further, what is the drivers behind the ultimate escalation mechanism and really become comfortable to the degree that they become comfortable with the two-year cost of service applications that are the current kind of process for OPG. So from that perspective, that is why it scores higher in my comparative chart than other options.
Travis, do you have a follow-up? Okay.
Fine, thanks.
Julie?
Yeah, just I was just wondering if you looked at all at the various deferral and variance accounts that OPG has and how that would fit into any sort of IRM model.
I haven't specifically looked into all the current laundry list, if you will, of those. I think that is something that must be done eventually. To a certain degree, there may be duplication in terms of the incentives that may have been built into the deferral accounts as part of a module, but I would suspect that that type of analysis would need to be done once you start dealing with the devil in the details type of assessment. And as I mentioned earlier, some of the deferral accounts are actually incentive enhancing too, because they create responsibilities and obligations on behalf of OPG to fund certain costs.
Yes, Ron.
Hi, it's Richard Stevenson from the Power Workers. I heard you this morning talking about the non-steady state issue. The various issues that are going to happen on the nuclear side, including Pickering Life Extension and Darlington and refurb and so forth. Just as a practical matter, I don't understand exactly how you envisage dealing with those kinds of items as a part of any IRM model. I mean, you identified the two problems that they present, broadly speaking. One is decreased production, and the other one is, you know, increased costs of a certain kind, which are not directly tied to actual output changes. But so how do you envisage dealing with that issue?
Well, actually, part of my recommendation is that I think there's less of an issue. It exists to some degree, but it probably can be smoothed depending on the term of the IRM plan or mechanism. But there's less of an issue with respect to those types of issues with a hydroelectric. So part of our recommendation is that one could begin fairly quickly and pragmatically with an IRM mechanism for hydroelectric. But for the nuclear, my recommendation is that it may be worthwhile to wait and not start immediately and at the same time as the hydroelectric plan, in order to allow for some, not all, but some of the influx issues to be resolved, because some of them are actually a function of policy determinations which are outside the scope to some degree of the board and of the regulated utility as well. So I think there may need to be a time frame where IRM is applied, the price cap, H7 options apply to hydroelectric, lessons learned are collated, and certain short-term to medium-term decisions are taken, and uncertainties to some degree of the timing, for example, of the retirements and refurbishments made, and that may allow for a little bit more of a pragmatic then foundation for the nuclear IRM in the medium to longer term.
By way of follow up, I hear all that, and that all makes perfect sense. But unless you're going to put off the nuclear IRM for 10 or more years, and maybe that's a good idea, but leave that aside, you're going to have to deal with this issue at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Because for at least the next 10 years, you're going to have these non-steady state issues. And so you got to deal with it.
Well,
and so when it comes time to dealing with it, what are you doing?
And this does also go back to my preference, or our preference and recommendation again for the building block approach, because you can deal with them on a very transparent and I would say granular basis, because you could look at expected production year on year, given the timing of outages once decisions are made as to the timing of the refurbishment and the retirement of certain generation. And those could be part of the buildup, if you will, to that forecasted revenue requirement that serves as the basis then for the glide path or fixed price schedule under this option of IRM. So I think it could be incorporated. I'm not saying that it's without its challenges, of course. Even if you can identify those, identify the timing and magnitude and plan for it, and maybe that the term of the IRM is still too short to necessarily bridge some of these fundamental long-term considerations, and you may need to look to setting up deferral accounts and other mechanisms to allow for that to go across generations. If one were to make the decision that you needed to start, it was imperative to start the nuclear IRM in the short term. So I think there's a level of pragmatic policy change and rate-making considerations.
Any other questions from the floor? Operator, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please ask if there are any questions online, please.
Thank you. Please press star 1 at this time for any questions. There are no questions registered at this time, sir.
Thank you. And Richard?
This is an unrelated one. On a go-forward basis, in terms of the development of a potential plan, you know, we've had a couple of relatively high-level overviews presented today. You know, what would your recommendation to the board be in terms of sort of a minimum process that you would envisage necessary to come up with an implementable plan that's been subject to enough rigorous review that you would be comfortable saying to the board, this is implementable? Where do you, you know, if you get to pick the roadmap between here and implementation from a developmental perspective and a board review perspective, what does it look like so you're comfortable?
I'll take a crack at it, and I suspect OPG might have their views as well. I think where you're correct in that we've stayed really at the 10,000-foot perspective at this point. We've qualitatively assessed options, and I've repeatedly kept have said this morning and this afternoon, devil's in the details. So I think there needs to be a process set up to start considering options for those details, for parameter values. And how one would go about supporting rigorously and reasonably supporting parameter values and choices across models. And it will be, in my opinion, it's best served through a consultation process and through a combination of pragmatic wisdom. The same type of wisdom that goes into a cost of service rate case as well, to some degree, but probably with additions that may have not really been considered yet, because we're probably most likely talking about time frames that extend beyond the current 2-year cost of service rate making process.
Any other questions from the floor? Okay. You will have opportunity for any written submissions to have any other comments or facts or opinions which you'd like to put before the board staff. Okay, we'll move to the next presentation. We're going to be ahead of our agenda here. It's George Fitzpatrick, who's making a presentation on nuclear performance standards, the U.S. experience. And let me try to get your presentation up here, Joe.
I don't think so.
Okay. Operator is okay. We're proceeding to the next presentation by George Fitzpatrick. It should be up on your screen.
Okay.
I think we're ready to go, George.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is George Fitzpatrick. The title of my presentation is Analytical and Regulatory Issues Surrounding U.S. Nuclear Performance Standards. And it really is based upon my experience in this area from 1984 until the present day. The purpose of my presentation is to share my experiences and perspectives related to nuclear generating station performance in the U.S. and the development and evaluation of nuclear performance standards for many of my U.S. nuclear utility clients. This is a sort of a snapshot of the work that I have done in the U.S. nuclear industry as an expert witness, specifically based upon comparative life cycle economic studies of nuclear versus coal, gas, renewables, even demand-side management alternatives. I've done a lot of cost and performance and benchmark modeling on a variety of issues, from capacity factor, O&M costs, capital additions costs, staffing models, and issues of that nature. I've designed performance standard and evaluated the performance standard designs of others. I focused as well on staffing models for nuclear facilities, whether single units or multi-unit sites, and I provide expert testimony on all of these subjects. Okay, we go to the next slide. Historically, at least in the history that I'm aware of, 1984 to present, the state regulatory commissions have focused on nuclear generation, and they focused always on safety. Safety is the of paramount concern to state commissions. It's the paramount concern to all nuclear operators. It's the paramount concern of senior management, all the utilities and holding companies that own these facilities. It's paramount concern of the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States. There's a great deal of focus on safety beyond all else. After September 11, 2001, security became a significant component, and it took a little while to ramp up. Not that it always wasn't good, but there's been a sort of a significant increase in the amount of security, the training of the security, the costs incurred for security. And I've even looked at that fairly carefully, and you can see certain patterns emerge depending upon the nuclear facilities that are being evaluated. Historically, in the rate case situation in the U.S., we've always looked at capacity factors, forced outages, refueling outages, costs and durations, operation and maintenance costs, and capital additions, not just historically, but projections of those cost elements. And basically, the point here is that they've been looked at as part of a rate proceeding where we're looking at historical costs and pathways for the future, what are the future projections look like. And basically what happens is utility management, nuclear management goes in and makes these projections. Some of the work that I've done is looking at the projections that are made by nuclear clients and looking about how reasonable are they, not from simple averages, which I'll talk about in a minute, but from model-based averages, depending upon the types of unit and a variety of other issues and modifiers that I'll go through later in the presentations. The point here is that these are not the subject of automated regulation by and large. They're the subject of specific inquiries into cost and performance as part of a rate case setting. In July of 1991, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission expressed concerns about nuclear performance standards and their impact, the potential impacts on safety. In their final policy statement in July 24 of 91, the following points were stressed. Certain forms of economic performance incentive may adversely affect the operation of nuclear plants and the public health and safety. Certain methods of measuring nuclear performance are of particular concern. And I'll just spend a minute discussing these issues. The use of sharp thresholds. In other words, if you set a performance standard for a facility of 80%, let's say, and the unit drops below 79.9%, that's a sharp threshold. And that's something that to be avoided. Short time interval measurements. If you're looking at annual capacity factors, they can be subject to such things as refueling. In the U.S., we're talking about now refueling, mid-cycle outages, safety outages, NRC outages for looks at different components of the system. And there are a lot of things that can occur that may force changes in capacity factor looking at the short time interval measurements. One of my clients for whom I've developed performance standards more than once, actually, we actually went from, we went to 12 months, 18 months, and 24 months. We look at a six-year window for evaluation of capacity factors for the plant, basically because we have three units. So there's sort of a formula as to the way you look at, you know, how long a time interval would be appropriate, as an example. Then they talked about the lack of null zone, which are dead bands, so that if your most likely capacity factor was, say, 80%, you might have around that some statistically derived analysis that would say it's between 74 and 86%. Sometimes they're not symmetrical, because what you find is in certain types of plants, you do not have a symmetrical distribution of capacity factors. So you almost have to replicate what the appropriate distribution is for the plant or the units that are under analysis. And finally, the NRC did not like the idea of commissions relying upon the systematic assessment of licensee performance, which basically says, we found an issue, we went out and we fixed the issue, we've had independent folks come in and see what we've done. They did not want that hindsight analysis to be the basis upon penalties, basically, because when you find something that was wrong with the design basis or find something you could be doing better, they did not want that to become an issue for safety. Okay. The NRC also said that, you know, they would continue to monitor state commission activity in this area. And I think the message there was there were some concerns at that point in time, the 1991 timeframe, that some state commissions would try to hedge the risk of cost. And they would basically try to impose these performance standards. In other words, being able to hold the utility accountable for sub-average performance, if you will. And also the NRC urged that licensees and commissions alike informed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about the NPS programs that were being considered so that the NRC could evaluate those and compare them to the template that they thought made more sense. The key points made in the final policy statement, from my perspective, and I think it's pretty clear if you read the statement, is that safety is paramount. There's nothing that should be done to compromise safety. They also said that they thought that nuclear performance standards could lead to some unintended activity actions. They also suggested broad null zones. They wanted to make sure there was wide enough, there was a wide enough analysis band or lack of reward or penalty bandwidth so that utilities would not get caught into even fuel cycle by fuel cycle, you know, variation in performance. And you do see that, by the way, when you look at nuclear plants over a long period of time, they don't really get to a static, steady state. There's variations that occur throughout the life of those units, and I'll discuss that a little bit more in this presentation. Also, they think longer-term intervals would prompt utilities to follow sound operation and maintenance practices as opposed to short intervals where you might be tempted to run the plant up to the end of the interval. And that's something that has been brought up. And one other point that the NRC recommended was to look at the utility's entire system rather than specific units. I've actually designed performance standards looking at the entire fleet of baseload generation for clients. And what happens there is you find that if you do have some variation, you know, you got to realize something, a couple of percentage points variation in nuclear capacity factor has a profound economic impact. So if you look at the entire fleet of baseload generation that a client or a utility client may have, you oftentimes see a different story because safety is the paramount concern of U.S. nuclear utilities. All right, here are some observations that I like to offer based upon hundreds of models that I've run for a number of different power plant types. For a number of my clients, they've been presented to commissions, they've been vetted with commission staffs and consultants, and accepted. Basically, what I found is that nuclear units, and I'm talking specifically now U.S. pressurized water reactors. We've also done similar analysis for boiling water reactors, but I'm not presenting that here today because there might be minor differences depending upon the vintage of the units. But we find that they go through a nonlinear maturing process. In the what I call the infancy stage of a nuclear unit, you have systems that have to come online, they have to be tested, they have to be shaken down. The human factor of the operating staff, they need to be make sure they're fully trained, they've got to be experienced with the reactors. They basically drive these reactors. I mean, there's a lot of automatic safety systems, but there's a way that you have people to get more experience with them, do a better job with them. So that's the immature phase. Then we find there's a ramp up in capacity factor, so like the midlife basis, where you start looking at things like steam generator replacements, reactor vessel head replacements. You're looking at the way they change refuel right now. So you find there's changes going on there. That's why we've seen the bump up in capacity factors. We have better O&M. We do have that, but we have better refueling. We still take mid-cycle outages, but we have better refueling. We've shortened the refueling by half. But you still need to take those surveillance outages at the other half, at the other end of that 24-month, or, you know, the other half of the 24-month fuel cycle. So basically, we see that towards the end of their life, we would expect to see capacity factors start to decline as they get to the end of the life cycle, and O&M costs go up because they get more, you know, the older facility. It's common sense when you look at, you know, the things that we have around us that we use. It's the same thing. We're looking at capacity factor is likely to decline and O&M costs may increase. And it really takes a lot of management effort initiatives to reverse that trend or hold that trend from actually going to the negative side. I also found that looking at industry averages to set targets is statistically inferior. All nuclear plants, from my perspective, are different. And when I run analyses on these and develop models, like, for example, I would either use an informed average where I'd look at a subset of plants that may give you a better sense of, like for example, if you look at combustion engineering system 80 units, that's a subset of nuclear plants that operate kind of the same way. There's some vintage issues there. But the real way to get at it is to do model-based, most likely performance estimators. I was looking before I came up here, I was looking at some of the models we had run, And what we do is we constantly kind of update the models. We kind of drop off old data, put new data on. But we have 427 unit years of observations contained in some of the models that we use for pressurized water reactors. You need a significant database in order to look at, evaluate, and decompose what are the affecting factors that affect one plant versus another plant. So that's a fair amount of work and a lot of effort. As an example, if we look at just USPWRs, there are about 11 statistically significant variables at a 90 to 99% confidence level that have significant impacts, positive and negative impacts, on specific nuclear plant performance. These factors, in my opinion, I've not done the analysis on CANDU, but these types of factors would also affect the CANDU type of unit. So all of these factors need to be evaluated statistically. It's a significant undertaking. And probably the last thing that, in my opinion, has caused the most effort and time is looking at extraordinary events that have to be excluded from any performance standard that I've ever worked on or recommended or analyzed. And basically what it says is extraordinary events are events that are outside of nuclear plant management's control. There are things that happen we don't have any control over. Earthquakes, for example. And they happen in the United States as well. We have an earthquake. We have a seismic event. The plant shut down automatically. We have floods. We have transmission lines going down. We have lightning strikes. We have all these things going on. They're extraordinary events, and you need then to go in and you need to segment that data or drop that observation out of the analysis. So there's a lot of components there, and based upon my experience, it takes lengthy discussions over many months. As a matter of fact, the most recent one that I was involved in, there was a list, I believe, about 70 extraordinary events that the parties, commission staff primarily, and the utility got together and put together. So it's a significant undertaking to understand those. It's even a more significant undertaking to normalize the data and the models and the model estimators for that type of information. Now, the following two slides, this slide and the next one, I've really included them to demonstrate that nuclear plants are different. Nuclear units are different from each other, and they're not different in terms of one operates at 10%, one operates at 80%. They're different in terms of how you set. You can't go with industry averages because, you know, the newer plants are going to run better. They run better. That's the way it is. So what happens is you have to adjust for things like maturing operating age. Where are you? Where are you in your life cycle? Immature operating age, now less of a problem right now because we don't have any plants in the, you know, years 1 to 6 of their operation. That was a problem in the old days. Cooling water type has changed. It used to be that freshwater plants outperformed saltwater plants. Not so anymore. Saltwater plants outperform freshwater plants, because water chemistry and the differences in what's in the fresh water, what, you know, where it's being taken from and things of that nature. Cooling tower types have an impact, whether it's natural draft or mechanical draft cooling towers. The containment type, we model that as well. We see statistically significant differences, as with reactor system type. It all has to do with maintenance and forced outages. Okay, if you go on to steam generators, we've seen a number of utilities go through steam generator replacement. The initial steam generator type will depend upon how well it operates through its what I call the midlife. And then once you replace the steam generator, you expect to see a bump up in capacity factor, but of late we've seen issues where that has not occurred. Reactor vessel head replacement, that again is a bump up to capacity factor. The commercial operating date of a unit, the older the vintage, the lower the performance, all else equal. And finally, fleet versus non-fleet. And this is, I think you need to consider this, because what I consider a fleet unit in the U.S. is a unit of similar type that's owned by the same operating company or holding company, because they have the advantage of learning from each other. They have online databases. They're constantly processing information. And plus, all their mid-cycle outages and fueling outages are planned by a central group of folks that move around, and they're constantly going from one to another. They know how to work on the units that they own. So that's a big component. When you have units such as CANDU with Pickering A, Pickering B, and Darlington, that's not a fleet, in my opinion. So I just want to make that clear. I think maybe you're not getting that because of the different vintage types, and I've not analyzed that at this point. Okay, some conclusions I'd like to offer is that we see nuclear unit performance in the U.S. for PWRs following an S-shaped trajectory that shows capacity factor increasing to its midlife and then plateauing and declining as it reaches the end of its life cycle. That's before, by the way, license extension and major plant, retrofits that build the plant up to basically like new condition, assuming that can be done based upon metallurgical tests. The early design and commercial operating date, the lower the expected life cycle capacity factor, all else equal. The challenge for nuclear plant management, and I meet with these folks periodically to go through what our models are telling us, and they actually go through it and they bench test the models in terms of their experiences, which helps me then analyze what new variables to consider, what variables are emerging, and it really helps not only me in presenting this type of information to regulators, but also helps the companies understand why they're doing at this level versus another plant which might be doing a little bit better or a little bit worse. But the challenge for nuclear plant management is getting the best performance from aging nuclear assets while maintaining the highest level of safety. From my experience, there is never a question, has never been a question about safety being compromised from any of my clients in my experience since 1984 when I started doing this work. And a key question for regulators, and this is a question we've asked in the United States in a number of state jurisdictions, will the imposition of an NPS cause plant management to operate any differently? From my perspective, the testimony I've heard from the interviews I've had with senior plant management, they'll always try for excellence to get the most out of those units, but safety is always the paramount concern. Incentives and penalties tied to performance standards would not change nuclear performance, in my opinion, in the short to medium term. Longer term, there might be, if there's good interaction with the commission, performance standards might be good to have, but they have to be long-term to affect long-term changes, which, by the way, might increase costs for new upgrades to plant, new upgrades to safety, new upgrades to refueling, and those kinds of issues. And the vast majority of U.S. state commissions I've worked with have reached, I believe, the same conclusion. I think there is one nuclear performance standard that I am aware of that was in effect for about 12 years. And it was in Georgia. Georgia Commission. Actually, I was part of the design team for that. A lot of the components of that I designed. But it was discontinued in 2004, and the commission found that it wasn't affecting the operations of the plant. That was their conclusion. And many U.S. commissions have opted for more frequent communications on cost and performance between commission staff and nuclear personnel. They've become more invested in looking at their nuclear facilities, understanding what's going on, and the very fact that utilities are reporting this, they report it anyway, so it's really one more important stakeholder that you deal with, and I think it's very valuable to open up that communications link. according to the NRC, in their 1991 final rulemaking or opinion, nuclear performance standards, they think, may have unintended consequences that could affect decision-making and safety. Now, I've not seen that in my years working with nuclear plant staff. They're very focused on safety. But what I have seen is that nuclear plant senior management, when you bring in a new plant operator, a new general manager, a chief nuclear officer, what happens is he doesn't come in by himself. He brings 30, 40 people in with him. He brings all of his high-level and mid-level management in. And the larger the facility, the more people that come in with him. And what I heard one nuclear plant manager say to me was, you know, I'm really concerned if we have a nuclear performance standard. I have some really smart people here who could actually run plants on their own, and they're working for me. They might say, you know what? We're knocking ourselves out here 24/7, and these fellows do work long, long hours, especially the senior management group. And he was concerned about employee morale and retention of qualified expert and proven senior management. And I think that may be something to consider going forward about nuclear performance standards and how they're applied and how they're administered. And I believe that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, George. I'll go to the online operator. Do we have any questions?
Thank you. Please press star 1 for any questions or comments. There are no questions on the phone line, sir.
Thank you. The floor is open for questions. Jay?
I guess I have the two questions. I'm not sure what we're supposed to take from your presentation. Is the conclusion we're supposed to take that you shouldn't have nuclear performance standards because they won't do any good, they won't help anybody, and the executives that work in the field don't want to be held to any particular standards? Is that the conclusion that I'm correctly taking from your presentation?
No, it's not. I think what I was hoping to convey today was that nuclear performance standards are complicated to design, and they need to follow certain methodological frameworks that provide the best objective view of these facilities. I'm mentioning this in terms of what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and, you know, some of the senior management of nuclear utilities have told me, in terms of I'm pointing out some of the potential pitfalls, and I think designing a performance standard that, first of all, is aware of the long-term nature of a performance standard that is optimal, aware of, you know, the null zones, the dead bands, and aware of how to compute model-based averages. Those are the kinds of methodological experience that I've had and I've developed that I think are worthy of consideration by the OEB.
So you're saying we should have nuclear performance standards, but they should be long-term in nature?
I think if there are I've seen commissions go with nuclear performance standards, and I've seen commissions not do them. I've been involved in a lot of the conversations and negotiations. As I told you, most of the ones I've been involved with, you know, utilities and commissions have not gone ultimately with performance standards because they are complicated to administer. However, there have been utilities or utility commissions that have done it, and they have not seen a great value in it. There's one that I know of that had a long-term standard for about 12 years. They can be done. I don't know how effective they will be, but they can be done, but they have to be done looking at some of the methodological lessons that we've learned in designing them. And I pointed them out in my presentation.
I guess I don't understand if the state commissions in the United States have essentially, with almost no exceptions, concluded that there's no value in them, then why would we have them?
That's a question that the OEB has to answer. I'm just offering my perspectives based upon what I've seen in the U.S.
Okay, thanks. Yes? Could you identify yourself? And maybe get to a microphone, that would probably help.
Mike Belmore, Society of Energy Professionals. Could you elaborate a little bit more upon the process of, now you said the NRC has requested that whenever nuclear performance standards are being considered or instituted, they ask licensees or regulators to sort of, it sounded like, vet those through the NRC. Could you talk a little bit about that process? Because in some ways, you know, this morning we heard a lot about the assumptions. I heard a lot repeatedly, you know, I assume that the CNSC and the the licensee and those sorts of things, but it seems like you're talking about something beyond a process of assumption that they're going to meet regulatory standards with the performance standards.
What I'm aware of is that we've gone through this performance standard evaluation process with a number of clients. I've testified, I've put performance standard recommendations before the commission as the commission has requested. You know, if the commission requests the company do it, I'll put it together and I'll put it out there. And many, like the most recent one we've done was in Arizona, where the commission, they came back and commission staff said that, you know, we think we need a performance standard for the Palo Verde units. And I provided testimony about how to do it. And they came back and said, you know, we don't have enough information on the record. And they ordered staff to work with the company. It took 2 years, basically, to come up with a performance standard that both sides would live with. And the commission looked at it and said, you know, we really can't tie rewards and penalties to this. So I think, but I think what's happened is, if you have a utility in the United States, a licensee, who is being asked by their commission to put a performance standard proposal in front of them, they, as a matter of course, will notify the NRC based upon this 1991 order and directive, or directive, I should say. So I think that's what's going on. So we want to know about what's going on because there's certain things that they believe that are problematic. You know, and I think they're right. I mean, clearly, what we design now is longer. We look at fuel cycle. We don't look at years. We look at fuel cycles. We look at total plant, you know, performance standards. You have fuel cycles. You have multiple fuel cycles, mid-cycle outages. You've got to make sure you got the right number of fuel cycles and mid-cycle outages in there to compare against your model-based estimator for most likely performance. But the NRC wants to know about it. And I don't believe, as far as I know, the NRC is not, you know, sending NRC staffers to the hearings. But I do believe that they're well aware of what's going on with it, and they do keep close watch on what's going on. So there's no performance standards put in that would violate what they think to be the appropriate ways to do it.
Yes.
Stan Bree for the Society of Energy Professionals. You mentioned that the fleet versus non-fleet, and Pickering A, Pickering B, and Darlington is not a fleet. Can you elaborate a little more about that?
Yeah, and this is my perspective. I've not done a specific analysis, but here's what I think is a fleet. If you have let me go with some of the ones that, you know, I know. You look at large pressurized water PWRs. Entergy is a good example of this. They own a number of those units, and they run those units out of the same planning group. They learn from each other. They're online databases where they gather experience on a minute-by-minute basis, and those plants learn from each other as they go. The vintages in those plants is not significantly different, nor the design bases. And Entergy was cautious about how they go and, you know, purchase assets. And you find also, you look at Palo Verde is another good example. It's a three-unit site, by the same componentry, by the same, you know, the operators in Comanche Peak can move from unit 1, 2, and 3. So they basically handle the same, you know, they handle the same way, if you will. They don't move them around as a matter of course, but what you have to do is they can move them. They're certified in all three units. All of that makes a difference in terms of costs. Now, I don't know that much about Darlington, but Darlington and Pickering, but they're different vintages. And from what the little I do know, they are different design bases. So that would have to be looked at before you could say they were a fleet operator.
Just one more question. In your data set, you mentioned that you looked at the PWR specifically in the U.S. Nuclear plants. Now, relatively speaking, how many of those units are similar to Pickering A and B, like in the 500, 600 megawatt range? Like in terms of population size, where if you were to establish a performance standard, how would you go about preparing something like that?
It's a matter of what error band you'd have to look at in the modeling process. There are no units. There are no 600 megawatt. There may be one or two 600 megawatt PWRs, but you know that's not enough to make up a sample. I think there are things to learn from all units. But the problem is that if you were to take, you know, let's say you took all the units, CANDU units in the world, and then you took, you know, PWRs in the U.S. for example, and you put it together in a model, the error bands, the null zones, would be larger because you don't have as much information to hone in on a tighter standard error of the estimate of the model, and plus it would be a non-normal distribution. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the best way I could say it.
Operator, would you check to see if there are any online questions?
We do have a question from Ali Agrami. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Ali Agrami from Society of Energy Professionals. Regarding the nuclear performance standards and the sort of benchmarking that our board is using, how do you correlate, and if there is a correlation, you can explain where that comes from, if part of this is using in that, or if there's any relationship.
Yeah, I apologize. I didn't hear your whole question. I'm sorry.
You spoke about the nuclear performance standards, and the board is using a sort of benchmarking that is used for the cost of service determination of the price. Is there any correlation between this set of values that you calculated and those standards that the board is using?
I am not familiar enough with the board's calculations to really give you an answer on that question. I'm sorry.
Ali, did you have a follow-up question?
Please press star one again, Mr. Glummy, if you have a follow-up question. Please go ahead.
That's all right. Thank you.
Okay, mine is actually, I'm sorry, Judy Quick, the consultant to the Power Workers Union. Mine is actually a follow-up on Ali's question. Can you talk generally, in general terms, about the ability to benchmark nuclear plants?
I can talk generally about benchmarking nuclear plants because a lot of my clients like to do that. They like to look at capacity factors, forced outage rates. We look at capital addition spends and streams. We look at O&M costs. We look at staffing. And we can model, you know, we can develop models for all of this. But models are just not blind statistical analyses. They have to have a certain amount of vetting with experts and I do that. I mean, I know a fair amount about them right now, but I'm really a statistician and econometrician. with some background in it. And so it's important. You can do the analyses, but then once you do the analyses, it can serve as an overall guide.
Mm-hmm.
But so the answer is yes, you can do it, but what you use it for and the error around what your most likely estimates are will vary depending upon the type of unit and what you're looking at, what the metric is you're looking at, and whether or not we have a significant, robust database to evaluate it and make model-based estimates of it. But I think it's a good way to do it, to look at, to get an idea of where you fit. But when you start using something, you know that maybe has a 10% or 15% plus or minus whatever, 8, 9% variance for a U.S. reactor, then you've got to say, what is the value of this? And a lot of companies look at it because they want to know how they're doing, because it's a competitive industry. They, you know, the people that run these nuclear plants, they want to run them at the highest capacity factor they can, consistent with 100% safety, or as much safety as 100% they think is going to get them. And they spend money, you know, on, like, refueling. They'll spend money on refueling systems and, you know, quicker turnarounds and things like that. They'll do it because they want to enhance operations. So all of that is analyzed. We look at comparative life cycle economics. We look at what the statistics are for utilities that put these in place. That's all looked at. So it can be done. I think it's valuable, but you got to be careful what you use it for.
Okay, thank you. One more question. On the slide that's up right now, the first point, you say that there are frequent communications between commission staff and nuclear personnel. The commission staff, are they actually nuclear experts? Do they have that technical understanding?
That's a good question. When I'm involved in those kinds of meetings, you know, I'm not a nuclear expert. I know a fair amount about it. I'm an expert in modeling of nuclear activities. And what you have is commission staff, which could be nuclear experts, but they'll bring in nuclear, other nuclear experts from the outside, as well as statisticians that do what I do. And we'll look at this, and, you know, because it's very important to have credibility in the kind of analyses you're doing. So it, in my opinion, it's valuable because, number one, it's not that the commission staff could say, well, you know, maybe you ought to do this instead, but they understand it, and they can ask questions about it and inform their commissioners about it. So the commissioners now know what's going on, what are the challenges for a specific unit, what are the benefits, and you get to learn the units in your service territory and your jurisdiction. I think it's very valuable.
Thank you.
Jay?
Did I hear you say, sir, that most of the people you're dealing with in the United States are competitively priced? Their output is competitively priced?
No, sir.
No,
you
so
didn't
they're,
hear
most,
that.
They're mostly on a cost of service basis?
What I meant to say was this, that every nuclear plant, their objective is to run that plant at the highest capacity factor that they can, consistent with safety. Whether, you know, and they're under a cost of service basis, but that's the objective of these plants, is to run them. When they're available, you run them. If you look at capacity factor versus availability factor, when a U.S. nuclear plant is available, it runs. So capacity factor equals availability factor.
Okay, but I'm trying to understand your comment that these are competitive companies. They're not competitive in the sense they're not price competitive.
No, sir. But let me just say this. The more a nuclear plant runs for a regulated utility, the lower the cost to consumers, all else equal.
But the shareholder doesn't make more money.
No.
And then the second part of my question is, did I understand you to say that you have not looked at CANDU at all?
I have not looked at CANDU in terms of the operation. I've looked at the Power Advisory Report, but I've not done any analysis looking at CANDU operations and costs and performance. No.
The Scott Madden Report talked about CANDUs as having a number of different operating parameters, and indeed OPG has said a number of times that
sure.
CANDU has different operating parameters. Is it possible that some of the conclusions you're reaching that deal with PWRs would not be applicable to CANDUs?
It certainly is possible, yes.
That has to be studied to know for sure.
That's true. I think if you're going to look at CANDU to see whether you can develop a robust benchmarking process for CANDU units, there may be some information in USPWR operations that could add value to understanding CANDU performance. There may be some. So there's a way to do that, to combine that in a model and model it in such a way that you know where the influences are coming from. But you'd have to, first of all, evaluate CANDU, you know, and vintage is very important, too. So, we would need to understand the vintage of the units, the vintage of other units, the regulations that exist in Canada versus wherever else these units are. We'd have to understand the regulations that they run under. That makes a big difference, too.
And the more you disaggregate the items on which you're benchmarking, that is, you're more granular about what you benchmark, the more the differences between CANDU and PWRs would matter, presumably, because then you'd start to bring in all their different operational characteristics.
I think you'd have to – I really have not done the analysis to tell you that, but I think you can look at it and probably be informed about it. I think it would give you more information than you have now, but still, can you develop a robust enough sample of CANDU operations to come up with a good performance standard upon which the company is going to have rewards and penalties? I don't know the answer to that right now.